This is the last panel. It's been an amazing day. I've learned so much, and I've come away inspired. What's really stayed with me is Ferdy's comment on the last panel about, you know, you're young and you find something and you just love it. It's like being in love, finding the music that inspires you. And we've got people who worked behind the scenes here. We've beside me, and the last time I sat beside Elvira, she said she got very ill. So here's over. Yes. So Elvira Butler, who ran, you know, as a young, and again, the team is the people that we've seen on stage today. When they were young, did extraordinary things. They didn't conform. They decided, I like bands, so I'm going to put on bands. I'm not going to wait for someone else to do it. And Elvira ran the campus in Cork, which was host to many, many gigs. And then we've got Caroline O'Sullivan from, again, it's not just punk, it's DIY. And Caroline was involved in the dance scene, which was such a huge youth culture in Dublin. And Caroline was a DJ. And if you're a DJ, you know, you have to promote and get people to your club. So we'll hear a bit about that scene that is kind of parallel to the punk scene. Then we've got Edwina Forkin, who was the first female ENTS officer in Trinity and went on to be a very successful filmmaker. And then we've Niall, who's really put on this event and was behind the whole initiative. And Niall was a part of the Hope Collective, who brought bands like No Means No, Fugazi, Quicksand, Chumbarumba, and Green Day, etc. To Dublin. So, because Elvira is the quietest, we'll start with Elvira. And
you're the quietest, most polite person on this planet.
Elvira, how did you get into music? How did you start organising gigs?
I started when I was 11 or 12. I grew up in a country town, which made me an entertainment, essentially. And I suppose my parents were always really kind of organising between them and kind of every committee in town. My mother used to be in Mission Interior. And for somebody who do, you know, some of the kids would tag along at the Sunday night period. And then somebody maybe suggested, why didn't we start our own kind of youth club? So we would get maybe just like a night a month, I can't remember. You were meant to be 16, and I think I was kind of going 12, 11, 12. But because I used to go there, you know, I was allowed to, and as long as we did something like a quiz, we could do music, and it had to be a little bit of an educational. But, and we got like, there's a couple of local kind of, I suppose, kind of beat groups, I can't remember whether they were good or not, but they seemed very excited when you were that age, kind of putting on. It was mainly discos. But my father then used to book the bands for the local, it was a voluntary thing for the local church, and opened up the ballroom in Paris. And so, like, by the time I was probably 12, I was going to see the Blue Jeans, and just wearing a funny John Cooper speaking. But as long as I went and sort of sat there with my coat on, I was allowed to go and kind of watch the band. So I don't ever remember a time in my life when there wasn't music around, you know? So although when I went to college then in Cork, first of all, I used to go to London every summer, and I spent as long as possible, like 4.5 months, you know, come back to Cork by kind of mid-October for late registration. And I'd go to loads and loads of gigs, and I'd see Miss Terrific and get these very eclectic bills on a Sunday night, 4 or 5 bands. The 100 Club, the Marquis, and I think maybe in probably 75, I think I saw the Field Goods at Hammersmith Odeon. But that maybe that, I mean, before that, I was sort of a hippie, I suppose. I loved Pink Floyd, whatever I saw then in 73, I think, on the first time in the college days. But even like I remember, like people saying that there wasn't much music. There wasn't a lot of, I suppose. Well, I mean, I don't remember, but I do remember kind of 73, 74 in Dublin. I'd be hitching up to Dublin to go to anything in the stadium. In a way, I suppose, because it was a little available, you'd go to anything, and that kind of maybe helped you to have quite a wide taste of music. So, you know, you'd go to the Incredible String Band, or with Gallagher, or Led Zeppelin, you know, whatever. And so I didn't start with punk, but I loved punk. And I remember seeing the Feel Goods on stage, and it was just sort of different. They were just kind of, you know, kind of, they were exciting. I also loved reggae, I suppose. So I mean, I did a lot of the reggae, got a lot of the reggae bands into Ireland. But I suppose I became kind of known as the punk promoter. Somebody said earlier, I think the first panel, about the fact that, you know, that punk bands didn't have agents, for example. That wasn't necessarily true of punk bands back then, because of course punk was like 77, we're all getting record deals or whatever. Now that, because they had record deals, that enabled bands to travel. They were getting, you know, they had tour support, I suppose. They also had, the amount of bands that were getting on Top of the Pops at the time, maybe 78, I can't remember. I was living in Cork at the time, going to college. I think we had one channel TV back then. So, you know, TV wasn't interesting, and you know, we really didn't get that much exposure to bands, but like Dave Fanning was great, because we didn't get the Dublin Pirate Radio. But we had like really small, you know, Pirate Radio in Cork. But generally, I mean, I suppose became exposed to a lot of different bands through spending my summers in London. And but of course, then when I started doing the gigs in 76, I mean, that had to stop because I was. So no, I started in the Orchid in 76 as Ed's officer. I kind of went up with my friends, you just kind of made me go up for election, which I actually hated doing because I'm not a public speaker. But there had been the sort of the same clique running the student union for years, and they were putting forward a candidate. So I kind of went up to the Disney candidate. And I mean, I think just people were kind of apathetic about who they voted in. So the fact that I was female, maybe, you know, I got the votes. And I don't know, somehow I just started, like when I started running gigs, I became absolutely involved. And I was running two kind of main ones a week on campus, plus a whole pile in the college bar, which the college authorities were trying to close down because it was doing very badly and they weren't kind of getting any funding. So by doing loads of gigs there during the week and even lunchtimes, you know, the bar started having people come into it. So I suppose I was encouraged. And then the Stardust Ballroom in Cork, which is like which was the ballroom at the time, approached me to ask could I do a student gig there when the college gig stopped in at sort of Easter, the exam time, I suppose. So I got, I suppose, a bit of a taste. I mean, in the college I had been able to do the Rats, for example, who weren't a punk band, but they had a punk attitude. So I don't actually look on punk as a genre, I suppose. I kind of look on it as, you know, just like fresh, the attitude is fresh, the attitude is different. And it, you know, it did, for me it encompasses all manner of bands from the time that, I mean, one of my favorite bands at the time was the Early Ones. And they were incredibly musical. Okay, they were like 78, I suppose, 79. But they were incredibly musical compared to, you know, a lot of the just kind of bands that worked in rhythm and you know, volume, I suppose, you know. So, but there were a number of bands like that, even the Feel Goods, they'd come out of the pop rock scene or, you know, so they'd been playing, even though they were young, some of them, like in the 20s, they were still old by punk standards, I guess. So they were very different experienced musicians, you know. And so yeah, I tend to look on punk as a sort of a kind of a, as well as an attitude and a kind of a movement, I suppose, an energy or something, rather than a specific kind of genre of music.
And you are, you know, you're acknowledged as the punk promoter, but you're also the post-punk promoter. And you mentioned reggae. You were instrumental in bringing a lot of reggae bands. And people in Ireland loved reggae. Reggae was one of the most loved music. Irish people love to dance, and they love that deep rhythm. And Caroline, you arrive on the scene, you know, way after the punk moment. And dance music was huge in this country. What was your experience of going to, were you going to see bands or were you just going to dances?
Well, for us, it was kind of a weird way in. I was a mod in the late 90s. There was a big mod scene in Dublin in the late 90s. There was a great band, some of you might remember, called the Josephs. And we used to follow the Josephs around religiously. And like, oh, there was a huge, quite good cultish mod scene. We'd go to gigs in Brussels, go to gigs in, you know. And then we kind of discovered dance music, you know, at the time, a lot of the clubs that dance music was being played in were in places that we would look okay in. It just wasn't really part of our scene. but we love the music. So then there started to be something like the Creation Raves, which were the raves out in Donegal at the beaches. And, you know, so we started going to these raves. So you said this weird thing happening where, you know, you'd the kind of typical raver people, and then you'd all this kind of heavy, you know, mod scene or people who are into this punk rock, arriving at these gigs, but like just being blown away by the music. So then, but as a, particularly as a woman, you couldn't really figure out a way into that, you know. It was like you go and it was this like mythical thing. And at the same time, like all my lab mates who were into the band of Josephs, they decided to start their own bands. And so the Things and the Mighty Steph and Humanzy all emerged from that. And we were kind of sitting looking going, yeah, that's great. I don't want to be in a band. I want to DJ. How am I going to do this? So the only way we could figure out to do it was just find somewhere that would let us DJ ourselves, because we didn't want to go ask anyone to DJ, because, I mean, they'd laugh at us. You know, can you really DJ? Show us your mix CD, or you know, and we'd just be like, no, we don't have them. We've got really good records, and we can guarantee we can make people dance, and it's going to be amazing. And they just, in our mind, we were just like, no, they'll just laugh us out the door. So, in fairness, Dermot Doran at the time was really good. Eamon Dorans was running gigs at times. This is all late night. This is all about 2000, 2001. Dermot had Eamon Dorans at the time, then he went on to Open Voodoo, he had Carnival Bar, and he just really supported us. He was just like, if you want a DJ, off you go. And we just, the lads were playing bands, and we're like, look, people don't really want to come and see your band, they want to come dance. So we'll get people there to dance, we'll do a lot of the work, the promotion, you play, you know, your band will play later rather than early, because no one's coming to gigs at 8 o'clock. Let's go on at 11, go on at 12 or 1. We'll DJ before and we'll DJ after. And so that's kind of how it came out and really started. So we kind of had a team, the lads and the things, Steph from the Mighty Steph, myself, Gary from Humanzy. We'd kind of take turns promoting a night, and you know, one would headline, one would DJ, the other would support. And we just kind of this cyclical thing of just mainline as well at the time. And we just go, and we was like, right, what can we do? Where will let us play? Where will let us take over? So we won't, you know, and where can people just get messy and hang from the ceiling if they want? But just that it's like, let's play loud music, and that we want to play dance music. We're hearing all this amazing music at like raves and dance music gigs, but they're never going to let us play. We're not cool enough for them. So let's just do our own thing. And that's kind of where it came from.
Right, okay, thank you. So learning how people got started. Edwina, how did you get started in promoting and putting on music?
Well, it was all Mick McCallaghan's fault and your fault. If he's here, I don't know. So I was 16, and I suppose I got involved in the Dublin Jazz Festival to begin with Ronan Guilfoyle and Conor Guilfoyle, and actually DJ Dara came, he was one of the brothers who's in New York, but they were all very involved in the jazz scene, so that was the first time I got involved in helping that a gig. And I just remember going into Trinity to loads of gigs, and just, you know, that was the best thing to learn all about the music, was just going into Trinity, see the bands, go to Bag It In, McGonagall's, the New Inn. I mean, there's all these amazing venues, so, and St. Francis Xavier's Hall, SFX. And I mean, there was just, so you just went and saw the Smiths, Dead Can Dance, you know, the Ramones, you know, there's all these bands going on. So we're very lucky. But so when I got into Trinity, I just had in my head, I'd love to be an officer. And there wasn't, there was no female, I didn't know actually when I was growing up, that I was the first female ENTS officer to actually go for it, to run election. And again, it was kind of the same old, you know, there was quite a laddish thing, and it was hard to break through that. But I was very lucky because I'd been, I suppose, around the music scene, people knew me, and I got the vote. And I had promised that I'd try and cater for loads of different tastes in music. So we had everything from, you know, the lunchtime gigs to kind of doing jazz and to, you know, doing stuff in, like we had Paranoid Visions play in, the atrium, which was the first time we ever used the venue, was like the poshest place ever in Trinity. And I said, okay. And I blagged, I don't know how I did it, I said, you're going to do this abortion information gig, because it was the right information at the time. And back then it was illegal to even have a t-shirt with a phone number, with a phone number in the UK. And magazines like Cosmopolitan would black out telephone numbers for abortion information. So I decided to do an abortion information gig. And PJ, if he's here, Paris, Paranoid, anyway, they were headlining. And I don't know who else played, but it was really, they trashed the play. I think it was the last time a gig in the atrium. But did the Golden Horde play that one?
Which
the
one?
Golden Horde played a lot for you.
Yeah, Golden Horde played a lot for me because I thought they were brilliant. They were just a brilliant band.
Yeah, we played the issue.
Yeah. Did you?
Yeah, I think
so,
yeah.
So there you go, yeah. And that was, you guys were there as well. So that was a pretty amazing gig. And again, even the DJ scene, I'm going to tell you a funny story, was we got an allowance grant by Records. So from ends from Little Kitty, so we'd go out and buy records, and every Wednesday we'd have, I give people a chance, like Tom Bailey and all these people started going, go on, you can be a DJ. So we kind of encouraged people to become DJs, and they'd play the records on a Wednesday. And it was always like brilliant. Then we all went on to Fibbers then after, you know, like later after Trinity, people then started playing in Fibbers, and then it was the Waterfront. So that all kind of came out of, I suppose, Trinity Days as well. So I suppose, you know, like I just loved doing music, gigs, bands, just therapy were around. I mean, you had, you know, you were doing gigs and some people would stay up at my house, either in rooms in Trinity, but after, you know, a lot of bands I would have put them up, and, you know, there's a few funny stories about that, but that's for later. But really, I just, and I thought Ferdia was brilliant, in love with music. That when you said that to me, it just really, you know, hit me. And I think that was really it. We just wanted to see bands come to Ireland, hear music, and just make it happen.
You almost introduced Niall there during your conversation. So, you know, your last point.
And Not Our World.
Yeah. Yeah, Niall's band, Not Our World, played in Trinity quite a bit. But Niall, you had that same impulse, which was, I want to bring bands to play in Dublin. I like bands and they're not coming here, so let's do it. And how did that happen? How did that begin for you?
It's hard to really say. I was in a band and I wanted to play a gig, so we put a gig on and played a few gigs, and then it just seemed like a natural thing that you don't wait for someone else to do it for you. You know, you just if you want to play a gig, you go out and play a gig. You don't ask someone, can you get me a gig? And then I started listening to kind of more punk bands, and I wrote a fanzine and started writing to bands. And one of them asked, or maybe I even asked, why have you never played in Dublin? And then 4 weeks later, got a reply, yeah, because nobody has ever asked us. And then 4 weeks later, said, well, come on over then. And that's really how it started, because they just said nobody asked us to play. And I think Roisin might be still here, but John Robb is the person who I wrote it. He was in a band called The Membranes. But he wrote for a music magazine at the time called Sounds, and he knew loads of bands. So when The Membranes came to Dublin, they enjoyed themselves. And then John Robb went back and told all his friends, oh, you should go to Dublin, it's great fun. And that's kind of how it started. And then bands just like asked, oh, I hear we can now come to Ireland. I'm like, well, you can always come and we'll try and help you. And then a band called Anne Revan from Wales were kind of the next lot, and then it just kind of grew from there.
You brought that Cinderella's, wasn't it?
Yeah, Tom Pollard, I think, was involved with that as well. Yeah, but it was just loads of different bands. It's all word of mouth.
Yeah, but it wasn't quite as easy as you're making it sound. The bands would just say, Niall, can we come and play in Dublin? You had very, very strict rules about who you would allow to play on your gigs.
Well, I suppose.
Well, the rules, I don't know if the rules are enough, but if a band was on a major record label, then they didn't need me to put them on. The major record label could organise it for them. And that's probably, that was the rule, really, you know. So we only would put on a band that didn't have the whole trappings of the music industry. For two reasons. One, because they already had it, but the other reason was, we never gave a band a guarantee, so we never signed a contract, never gave a band a guarantee. It was like, well, if you want to come over, we'll try our best, and hopefully you'll have a good time. It was a different era, of course, but as we put a name on the whole promotions, became the whole collective. It was conscious never to be part of the music industry. There was never a wish to be part of an industry where you had to rely on getting paid. So we paid into the gigs ourselves, consciously, and never had a guest list consciously, and just went, all right, well, the music industry is fine, that's the road, whatever road you want to travel on, that's fine, and we'll go down this little small laneway or whatever, but it's our own road, and we're quite happy with that.
Yeah, again, you say small laneway, but, you know, to me, one of the gigs that has stayed with me my whole life is the show you put on in the SFX, you know, where, you know, we'd seen The Clash, we'd seen The Smiths, you know, where big bands played, and the Hope Collective put on Fugazi and Chumbawamba and In Motion, you know, and you sold out, you know, a major Dublin venue with your very strict rules or conditions that, you know, bands of major labels could make their own scene, but that you were interested in that one. Just want to go back to Caroline, because punk rock and, you know, you mentioned coming out of the mod scene, and you mentioned Donna Mead, Beaches. What was going on Donna Mead Beaches that I didn't know about?
There was a group called Creation, they used to put a raves on the late 90s. Into Donna Mead, sorry, actually not Donna Mead, but there would be literally, and it was back to that thing of like the, you know, the mythical thing that we'd heard about that happened in the 80s suddenly started happening like in the late 90s, early 2000s in Dublin, where no one had a mobile phone, no one was really on the internet. You'd hear a word, there was going to be a rave, you'd get a taxi out to a beach and you'd start walking and hope that you could hear some music. And usually you did, and sometimes you didn't. And there was, you know, some cases where you'd be walking around sand dunes for like till 6 o'clock in the morning going, what are we doing? What has our life become? There's no sign of anything, we'd be killing each other. Because no, every thought you knew where we were going. But then other times, you know, you just go and you find it, and it'd like literally be magic. Like the particular one, I remember going to Ballymore Eustace, and I was only driving not very long at the time. And I'd never driven in the dark. So but of course I had a car, so my mates were like, right, you're driving. I was like, okay. So we drove to Ballymore Eustace, and we had to stop at a payphone and ring an answering machine. This is 2003, 2004. And you know, we got to Ballymore Eustace, and we parked the car and like started following the people, and there was this disused quarry. And I had to stay in Ballymore Eustace like for like nearly 2 days, because before I was afraid to get back in the car to drive. But, and I remember, you know, one of my mates that was with me, she was working at 2 o'clock on the Sunday, so her mom had to drive to Ballymore Eustace to come get her so she could bring her to work. But it was just like totally, it just blew our minds that this stuff was happening. And I said, you know, you'd heard all these stories of these raves that had happened in the 80s and 90s, and that, you know, we'd known people maybe had gone to the Mansion House raves, but we were just that little bit too young for that. We weren't, you know, we just wouldn't have been allowed in. But yeah, we could, they re-emerged again, and yeah, the Creation raves all over that period were just amazing. And we, you know, it just was such an eye-opener. You just didn't realise that this stuff happened. And particularly as someone who'd come from the mod scene and into rock bands, and then all of a sudden you're just like, you know, dancing in a disused quarry. God, this is great.
Yeah, but as you would, if the prospect was we can walk around at the beach in the dark for 5 or 6 hours with nothing happening. If you did hear music, I can imagine, okay, we're off. Elvira, you ran a little bit more of an organized event down there. But particularly interested, you talked a little bit before about some of the reggae acts. You were bringing reggae acts, and then you were also putting them on in Galway.
Well, yeah, some of the reggae acts I brought in, because I just noticed that I found a lot of old material recently, and like, there were 10 dates like for some of the reggae bands. So there were Sligo, Thurles, and I don't know, it was Kenny Bevis, or some kind of Megan, I think. I mean, there were places that, I don't even have been there, but it must have been. And these were bands that were well known. Part of the reason I think, I mean, I loved reggae, but when I came across, I mean, I had reggae, I suppose, kind of reggae, Blue Beat, you know, earlier on, without knowing what it was, I didn't know what the genre was really. But it was when I got a friend from London brought over a copy of, I think it may be in 74, Bob Marley's Catch a Fire, which I still have, the Zippo lighter. And I just had enough of that album. And so I started, I suppose, discovering more of it. And a lot of the, even though like, the punk bands did have, a lot of punk bands, I mean, did have agents. Reggae bands didn't have agents. And particularly if they were coming from, say, the, you know, from Jamaica, I think it's generally. So, I mean, I was competing with like, the men. And I suppose, you know, I mean, at the time, was I aware that like I was kind of, you know, different and fighting my corner? I don't know. But like, I suppose whatever, I was probably determined to fight it. So I kind of, I suppose, struck up a relationship with some in reggae bands, but also a couple of agents, small agents, who weren't kind of. I mean, having said that, the first bands I actually did independently of the college in 77, now this is Dr. Feelgood, in City Hall, and then the Stranglers. They were like, ooh, edges. Well, the Stranglers are very edgy, because I didn't have college backing.
Okay, hang on. So you bring the Stranglers, who were the first of that punk new wave, whatever you want to call it, movement, to have consistent chart hits. So they're not some niche act. They're one of the big selling Top of the Pops appearance bands. And you bring them and you put them on in Cork. And they're not. Their reputation was that they weren't the best. Genteel.
Well, they had the Finchley Boys with them as well, and like they were, you know, they had to be seated gig because I couldn't get City Hall without it being seated. And the Finchley Boys were saying, those seats had to come up by then. I had no, you know, I got insurance because it was seated. So, but it was a really, it was a brilliant gig. I mean, it's totally memorable because, like, it was like fighting stuff. People were kind of up on, you know, kind of window ledges, kind of three stories high in City Hall. Going to jump off, you know, balconies and stuff. And I mean, this is, I had no experience of, because up to this, I'd only been running either in the college or for the Stardust Ballroom, which I was only really booking the bands for. You know, I mean, I did try a little Whole Food Cafe there. I mean, I was going back to, somebody mentioned tofu burgers and hippies. Yeah, well, that was me. But, like, also, like, when the Arcadia then, Peter Pentecost in the Arcadia, and like, his right hand man, kind of big bouncer guy, Morgan, approached the college to say, well, you know, why didn't I go down and try to increase the Arcadia? This is my second year, I was kind of brought back as this. And I just thought it was a great idea because it always struck me as crazy that I couldn't run gigs on college during like, you know, Christmas. Stephen's night, all those good nights, Paddy's night, you know. The nights that you knew would be, because I've been going to gigs since I was 11, 12. I knew the nights that worked, you know. So anyway, I think it started that in November 77, and the student union president at the time was kind of, he went to the music and totally negative about it all. So I got 6 weeks together to make it work, and of course I was starting at not the best time to be to. But I just knew if I kept going until students night, it would work. The radiators actually paid for me. People forget they paid outside of them, but they played in the Stardust in April 77, because Pete actually put something on Facebook some time ago saying they played in the Bagadier, which was like the first single, the night before, and it was like rubbish or something, then they played a Cork pack. I mean, I can't remember how packed it was, about 800 people, so. And then they played, I haven't booked it for Christmas that year, but they, 77, but they, for some reason, they ended up playing in January. So they did play, and like, I know they had like at least 850 people.
But that's really important because the Radiators, when they came back from England, they couldn't play in Dublin. That's very important to remember that the National Stadium, which was run by the Irish Boxing Association, didn't think that punks should be allowed, or anyone who was associated with the punk movement. So the Radiators were effectively shut out of the bigger venues in Dublin, the only big venue. You were putting on probably the biggest concerts in Ireland and not in Dublin, Cork. And I was fascinated to hear that Bernie was saying, you know, I used to read Vox magazine, there was people talking about, you know, going down to the Arcadian Cork. You were putting on really big gigs, but one of those gigs that you put on, and I'm not saying you started a riot, but in my opinion, you caused one. With a group that I don't associate normally with riots, and it was with The Cure. You brought The Cure to play
the board. Yes. I mean, I brought them to Trinity for the Trinity Board. In fact, I actually had to call the police that night because I think there was some crowd that got in who were intimidating and trying to cause trouble. Because I didn't do it, and I don't actually remember why. I didn't do a public gig in Dublin with them. It might have been because they weren't available, or because Dublin. I was living in Dublin from 79, so even though people associated me with Cork, I was actually running a lot of Dublin gigs. And all the reggae bands, I would do them either in sort of the TV club or in McGonagall's. I mean, Trinity was due during term time because they pay, you know, they buy a Dublin gig to scratch. I'd be guaranteed some money for people to happen. But, and so The Cure played the ball, and I ran buses down to Cork for the Cork gig. And I do remember having to get on the bus in the morning and sort of say, look, I'll be here in the early afternoon. If you don't behave, that's the last of it. Because of some of these people, I could have been causing trouble the night before. But the only trouble, it made the front page of the papers, the Cork Examiner, about the riots. But it was, as far as I could figure out, there's nothing in the venue. I never had trouble. I actually employed, it sounds heavy, but I employed army guys as my bouncers. I think I had about eight of them. But the beauty of them was that they knew how to handle themselves. So they never had to wade in for some kind of minor thing. I told every member a fight in the Arcadia that I was afraid to walk into myself and say, look guys, you know, cup starts on. We just didn't have it. Even if people Cork people are, they've got there was in that program recently where, about the Arcadia, you too. Where was it now? Stroke said something. So something in the water in Cork, you know, with the people. It's true. I mean, the people would get like really, you know, they were a mad audience, but they weren't a rough audience, you know. Mm-hmm. The people who were arrested, I'd actually just thrown out of court on the Monday by the judge, who kind of said that these guys were either they were even drunk or they weren't drunk, you know. They were from Exford or Wicklow or something. People I used to travel all over to the gigs.
The Goths from Wexford ruined everything. Caroline, what venues were you, you know, because I wasn't around for the rave scene. Like, how big was it and where were people playing? And was it Irish DJs? Was it global DJs? How big did it become, that dance scene?
It started to become really big, but as I said, it was something that, when it was in the club parts, you know, there was like the Kitchen and all those types of clubs. But then where we kind of tried to take, we tried to just run our nights in our own, you know, in our own separate things. And then we'd been DJing the club for a couple of years, and then we kind of started to tie in, and we used to play the pod a lot. So in the mid-2000s, you could have like up to 1,000 people in the pod on a Saturday night, and there would be like 4 rooms with DJs. So, you know, it was at that, you know, where 2005, you know, where things have become much more formalised, the guards were kind of clamping down on the more illegal stuff. So there was, and it was, you know, nightclubs had kind of become again that they weren't, you know, they were a bit less restrictions. They weren't expecting people to come in and look as formal. You could just go in and dance and go, or be allowed in with runners and stuff like that. So yeah, by about 2000, before the pod closed down, pod was probably the biggest venue, and that would be holding about 1,000 on a Saturday night.
Edwina, were you genre specific, or you mentioned earlier you were trying to put on something for everyone in Trinity? Like what bands, what genres were you putting on?
I think we did the last The Voice of Beehive, Primal Scream, My Bloody Valentine. I tried to get REM. I tried to get the Gypsy Kings. The Gypsy Kings came another year, but I tried to get them back again. Put on The Real Sounds of Africa.
Obviously Therapy.
The Golden Horde Therapy, not a word. I mean, you would like, you'd hit a residency with the Golden Horde and Therapy. But they would have been kind of the music I would have, but I loved all sorts of music. I even brought Bull and Ireland Layabouts in from the UK. And
and And were you just putting on gigs in Trinity, or were you using outside venues?
Yeah, yeah, I was doing the same kind of, I would bring, say with Primal Scream, we brought them in to Trinity, did maybe, I think, Valentine's Ball, and then I put them down to Galway, or they, I don't know if they played Cork, but they did Belfast, I think, so we would bring them in. So I did one or two gigs in McGonagall's, which was a brilliant, because McGonagall's was just an amazing venue. So that would help pay for, like Trinity would pay for it, and then we put on another gig. And we didn't really make that much money. I think we put on a screen. We just did it because we wanted to have them play. So it wasn't about making money. Do you know what I mean?
Yay! Yay!
And actually, I remember, like, with Primal Scream, they were like, you know, the rider, and, you know, you had to give them loads of drink, and you had to put them in this posh hotel. And I had the tiniest little cottage up in, I think it was up in Dublin 8, and literally they wouldn't leave my house. They were like, you know, when are you going to go home? Or, so that was kind of funny. Or, you know, you'd always kind of have bands stay. Can I tell my funny story about therapy? Well, probably some people probably heard this before, but I think therapy were playing. It was NCAD, and I think you had asked me, or Michael, you had asked me, "Oh, Edwina, can you put them up?" And I was like, "Yeah, no problem." And Michael goes, "Oh yeah, by the way, they're straight edge," and I went, "Oh, that's no problem." I look, because, you know, I had all sorts of bands play with me. Party boys, not someone, party boys, whatever. So 1 o'clock in the morning, the lads came back from the gig, and literally I had a big rug, I had a big kind of bedroom, and I had a big rug, and I had pots of tea and Mr. Kipling cakes and sandwiches for therapy. And they sat around and we ate and drank, and then Andy pulled out a big bottle of vodka, and he said, "Here's this for you." And I said, "Can you drink?" And they were, "Yeah." And I started laughing, and I, so I said, "Right, crack that open." So he's obviously drank the bottle of vodka, but and I nearly killed him, because they just thought, you know, they were like, "Oh, we just thought you were the cutest person putting the, having a tea party in your room." But there you go.
No,
so
recollection
for
that. No history. Niall, you were also known for being quite strict when bands would make excessive demands. And there's the classic story of when Fugazi asked you to supply them with bottles of water. And would you like to tell the audience what you did when a band from the States who just sold 2,000 tickets or whatever, and they asked for some water from Niall?
I told them there was a shop that they could buy it. That's probably not one of my proudest moments, but like I said earlier, there was no guest list. We paid into the gigs, and bands are adults, and we were nearly adults. And so, if they needed water, they could bring it. That was the thinking. And in hindsight, I probably shouldn't have done that. I probably could have brought some water, the same way as I do for my kids' football team. But we put Fugazi on a couple of times. And they didn't ask for water the first time, so they asked, it might have been the third time they played, they asked for some towels and some water, it was both, and so we said, "No, go to the shop and buy some water yourselves."
No, and it is extraordinary, and obviously Niall was an issue for his hospitality, and bands did come, you know, bands that...
Well, sorry, if you don't mind, like, we put bands up in houses all the time, and we fed them and did everything, but it was just that kind of a rider. We just went to room. We're not getting a rider.
No, and I think the point is, you know, and so many bands came, and I think with all of you who put on rock bands, they had a really, really great time, and they felt that they were taken care of on a particular level that maybe they didn't experience elsewhere. They stayed in people's houses. It wasn't just, you're a band, so you're staying in a hotel, and here's the money to go buy your meal. It's, you're a band, and you're coming, and we'll host you to the best of our ability. And
you couldn't afford to let them stay in a hotel or buy them a meal. You're saying you're staying with us, and we're going to feed you, because you couldn't afford, you couldn't take the risk of, like, you might make any money in the show, so you had no choice.
And to me, that's the huge lesson of today, and we've got 25 seconds left. And I just want to sum up that the message today is that people can make up the rules. People find bands that they love. People fall in love with music, and it's the most
most amazing feeling. But all of you, you know, on this panel, as promoters, and we saw with the artists earlier on, you decided what you were going to do. You decided what was right for you personally. You decided what type of band you wanted to bring to Ireland and how to treat them. And, you know, as a music fan, I just have to say a big thank you for making my life so much better by the fact that I went to see lots of bands and saw that there were other ways to do things than the way that big corporate promoters and record labels do.
You know, just sorry before you end, Michael, you just reminded me, demo tapes were really important back then. Because I used to sit in my office and people would come with their tapes. And we used to listen to them and go, that's a pile of shit, or they're good. And that's, and I think those days are, I don't know, are kind of gone, but we used to listen to demo tapes and they were really important to show what the band were capable of.
And all the bands that Edwina said were shit, were demo
they'll
tapes.
Play.
Those demo tapes are now worth a lot of money. Okay, thank you very much, Derek, for
the
Thank you.